Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present National Nurses United Union President Gene Ross, who talks about growing concern that President Trump is rushing the distribution of a coronavirus vaccine before Election Day to gain partisan political advantage. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace, who explains why over 100 organizations sent letters to Donald Trump and Joe Biden calling for the next administration to adopt a new good neighbor policy toward Latin America. And Christopher Viles, director of American Studies at the University of Connecticut, who warns about the role of armed militia groups in undermining democracies as the U.S. faces an alarming increase in pre-election political street violence. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Mexico has a long history of high-profile government corruption. Since the early 1980s, four presidents have sought to put high-ranking officials from previous administrations in prison. The Economist magazine reports that officials in the administration of former President Enrique Peña Nieto, who left office in late 2018, was seen as the most corrupt in the nation's history. A former high-ranking official, Rosario Robles, is accused of siphoning off $400 million in government funds and has spent a year in detention awaiting trial. Mexico's attorney general issued an arrest warrant for Emilio Lozoya, the former leader of Pemex, the state oil company. In mid-August, the Mexican press obtained an explosive deposition from Lozoya, who is seeking protection from prosecution. He claimed he ran two schemes for Nieto. First, getting a $4 million bribe from Odebrecht, a Brazilian construction company that corrupted officials across Latin America. The second was $4.3 million doled out to members of the opposition National Action Party in exchange for their support for opening up the state energy sector to private investment. The allegations, which target the main political rivals of President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, also serve to distract from AMLO's mishandling of the COVID-19 pandemic and shrinking economy. They further discredit a demoralized opposition and set up AMLO's Moreno Party to do well in next year's midterm election. In the face of the worldwide decline in demand for oil, fossil fuel and petrochemical companies are pushing to expand their export of plastics to the developing world. An early target is Kenya, which is now in negotiations for a bilateral U.S. trade deal, a first for a nation in sub-Saharan Africa. In 2017, Kenya passed a ban on the manufacture, sale, and distribution of plastic bags. Eco-activists now fear it may be rolled back during trade negotiations with the Trump regime. In late April, the American Chemistry Council sent a memo to Trump's U.S. trade representative seeking to make Kenya a regional hub for U.S.-made plastics in Africa. Kenya is seen as a leader on rejecting plastic bags and is one of 190 countries that signed the Basel Convention, a global agreement. As of January, it will be much more difficult to ship plastic waste to poorer nations. The Trump administration has refused to sign. According to the New York Times, China's ban on imports of most plastic waste in 2018 has forced companies to seek new places to send it, but other countries, many in Africa, are increasingly saying they don't want it either. Last year, American firms exported over 1 billion pounds of plastic waste to 96 nations, including Kenya. These plastics have contributed to the pollution of rivers and oceans worldwide. As the coronavirus pandemic destroyed large swaths of the U.S. economy, Amazon, Apple, Google, Facebook, and Microsoft have only gotten richer during the crisis. These companies collectively boosted their stock price by one-third this year. The personal wealth of Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and Jeff Bezos have soared, becoming the new symbols of the digital gilded age of monopoly wealth. But as inequality in the U.S. continues to ravage working families, organized labor has failed to exert influence in the all-important tech sector. A According to Indies Times magazine, only 10% of tech company workers are members of unions in America's fastest-growing industry. Neither Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, or Facebook, worth a collective $7.3 trillion, are unionized. One of the only major unions that has launched an effort to organize the tech industry is the Communications Workers of America, whose lead organizer is Emma Kinema, co-founder of the video game industry group Game Workers Unite. She maintains that if the labor movement understood just how essential organizing in tech was, unions would be setting up organizing committees, as the CIO Labor Federation did during the 1930s, seizing the opportunity presented by the pandemic's unrest to undertake a massive and well-coordinated industrial organizing effort. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The Trump administration has dramatically failed in its overall management of the coronavirus pandemic, making the U.S. the hardest-hit nation in the world in terms of the number of cases and deaths. Across the country, over 6 million cases have been confirmed, resulting in more than 190,000 fatalities. The University of Washington's Health Institute forecasts that U.S. deaths will total 410,000 by the end of the year. In early September, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention notified public health officials in all 50 states to make preparations to distribute a coronavirus vaccine to healthcare workers and other high-risk groups as soon as late October or early November. The CDC notices were sent out the same day that President Trump stated that a vaccine might arrive before the end of the year during his Republican convention acceptance speech. Public health officials have long predicted that a safe and effective vaccine would not likely be available to the public until early 2021 at the earliest, given that Phase 3 clinical trials are required to ensure reliability, efficacy, and reveal any negative side effects. National Nurses United Union President Gene Ross, an RN, is among many healthcare professionals who are concerned with what appears to be a rush to launch a vaccine for political purposes. Here she talks about what she fears could be a scheme to cut corners in clinical trials in order to give President Trump partisan political advantage by launching a COVID-19 vaccine before Election Day.
You can have rushes put on things. You can have emergency authorizations, but you lose something when you do that. So when I talk about rigorous oversight by the organizations that are supposed to be watching out for our health, the FDA, the CDC, for example, when I talk about the kinds of things they're supposed to be doing, all the while you're using some of these things that have been pushed through in a rapid manner to help save lives, all the while you're doing that, you should be doing a study at the same time. Otherwise, all of that data that would have been taken is just out the window. And we don't really know, like let's say we were lucky and it worked. Why did it work? And was it just luck? Or is this truly something that can be used and used again for other people? So when we see other reasons put forward into that pushing and rushing forward, other than caring about the health of the public, then we worry, and I believe rightly so.
One of the difficulties I think the public will encounter in any vaccine when it comes out is overwhelming public concern that corners have been cut, that shortcuts have been taken, and that the vaccine may not be safe. Mm-hmm. How will the public determine what is safe for themselves and their family to take?
Well, hopefully what they will do is ask the people that can be trusted, like us. You know, we top the Gallup poll every year for most trusted profession, and there's a reason why. And the public trusts people like Dr. Fauci and other experts, epidemiological experts, and with good reasons. And so those are the people you can trust. Nurses are not going to say, yes, I would take it if I were you, if nurses are concerned that it was rushed through without the proper oversight. I mean, we just can't. People wouldn't trust us anymore.
We're in the midst of a presidential campaign, and former Vice President Joe Biden and California Senator Kamala Harris on the Democratic ticket have talked about some of the things that they would do if they win the presidency. From your point of view at the National Nurses United Union, what are the most important steps a new administration could take to immediately embark on controlling this virus and doing their best to get back to normal and engage in policy that the Trump administration has not?
Well, to start with, the two very important things that we have been lobbying for and having people sign petitions for from the get-go has been to get a temporary emergency standard under OSHA that says you will, as an employer, supply the type of equipment that these workers need in order for them to do their work and to not infect each other and their patients. You will do that, and that's of paramount importance. The other is the DPA, the Defense Production Act, which they're acting like they don't understand what it means. They say they've invoked it several times. Well, actually, the only time I've seen it be invoked was to say to the workers, you must get back to the meatpacking plants. But it's supposed to be instructing employers that are the most likely, to retool and get the PPE that we need. And then an overseer of sorts, completely transparent, that would make sure that the equipment we need gets to the spots where it's needed most and then stockpiles it so that we can draw from it. So instead of saying, well, we're looking all over at the countries that already make these types of equipment, no, you retool so that others can make them too and make sure that we have what we need when we need it.
That was National Nurses United Union President Jean Ross. Learn more about the process of ensuring new vaccines are safe and effective, and growing concern that President Trump has politicized the launch of a new coronavirus vaccine, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. More than 100 national and local groups have sent identical letters to President Donald Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden, calling on whoever wins the U.S. presidential election to engage in a new good neighbor policy toward Latin America. It takes its name from President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's foreign policy toward the region, even though his administration fell short of following the principles laid out. Those principles included non-intervention, non-interference, mutual respect, acceptance of differences, and working together for the common good. The letters were initiated by the group Code Pink Women for Peace, which believes that these principles could form the foundation of a policy that would allow the U.S. to restore peace and make a positive contribution to the well-being of people throughout the Western Hemisphere. The letter details outcomes the groups would like to see in six areas: ending broad economic sanctions, militarization, halting political interference, supporting the human rights of all peoples, and normalizing immigration and trade policy. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin, who contrasts the practices of both Republicans and Democrats with the goals identified in the letter, and explains how adopting these principles could benefit all nations in North, Central, and South America and the Caribbean.
We were looking at all of the terrible things the U.S. is doing in Latin America these days, and there was somewhat of a reprieve under Obama, not because they wanted to really give self-determination to Latin America, but because the U.S. was so bogged down in the Middle East that it couldn't put that much energy. And in the meantime, there were some very thriving progressive governments that were not only getting to power in Latin America, but creating alliances like the ALBA Alliance that was using Venezuelan oil to support some of the less developed countries. And then during the Trump administration, they hired some horrible characters to really go back to this very aggressive policy. In fact, they openly talked about the Monroe Doctrine, which is the sordid history of the United States and saying that Latin America is its backyard and gets to determine who has influence there. So we've seen the consequences of that in terms of U.S. policy trying to institute regime change in Venezuela, ramping up sanctions against Nicaragua and Cuba, supporting the government that came out of the coup in Honduras, supporting a coup in Bolivia, and then cozying up to right-wing governments like Bolsonaro in Brazil and ignoring the horrible murders of activists in Brazil, in Colombia, in Central America. And so we thought it's time to really come together and call for a radical new revisioning of U.S. policy towards Latin America.
I've been following the immigration issue closely and how things have deteriorated under Trump. But we also need to recognize that Obama was known as the deporter-in-chief for deporting 2 million people, more than any other president over his two terms. So, Medea Benjamin, could you please outline some of the things you'd like to see in that arena?
Yes. Well, we talk about just putting an immediate stop to the deportations. We talk about an absolute end of the family separation program, about not only giving the citizenship to the Dreamers, but a whole overhaul of immigration policy, respecting the right to asylum that, according to the UN, all people have when they are fleeing from violence and trying to get to a place of safety. And we also say we've got to look at things like the war on drugs that have led to such violence and forced people to flee, the economic conditions of neoliberalism and the privatization of so many key aspects of people's lives that have also led to economic deprivation that leads people to flee. So we combine the immediate things that have to be done around immigration to the larger issues of helping people to be able to stay in the countries where they live.
Do you know if Biden has committed to any of these things? I know he supports the Dreamers.
Well, he says that he supports the Dreamers and a fair immigration policy. A lot of it is sounding like platitudes, given that he was part of the Obama administration that was so bad when it came to deportations. But he is certainly more sympathetic to the immigrant community. He says he wouldn't continue the ban on immigrants coming from certain countries, and he certainly doesn't have the same kind of vile anti-immigrant rhetoric that has been so devastating during this administration and led to so much of the anti-immigrant sentiment. So I think things would be better for the immigrant community under Biden. And the important thing to recognize is that the immigrant rights community would have more of a chance of pushing him, just like the environmentalists have been successful in pushing him.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace. Find a link to the open letters sent to Joe Biden and Donald Trump and additional analysis of the current challenges facing Latin American nations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Not long after Donald Trump finished his acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention, 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse used his AR-15 rifle to shoot at demonstrators who had gathered for a Black Lives Matter protest of the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Rittenhouse, who had been with a right-wing militia group that evening, killed two social justice activists and injured a third. 4 days later, on August 29th, right-wing activist Aaron Danielson was shot and killed in Portland, Oregon, after a pro-Trump car caravan drove into the city center, triggering clashes with progressive activists. Right-wing and white supremacist militia groups have been active in the U.S. for decades, reaching a peak of activity during the 1990s, around the time of the April 19, 1995, Oklahoma City bombing. That domestic terrorist attack carried out by Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols against the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building killed 168 men, women, and children, and injured more than 680. As the U.S. prepares for this November's presidential election, amid the worst health crisis in over 100 years and an economic crash, tensions are running high. What's unique and dangerous in this volatile moment is that, unlike any other president in modern U.S. history, Trump is praising and encouraging militia groups and vigilantes who've confronted and at times attacked Black Lives Matter and other progressive activists, inviting more violence. Your reporter spoke with Christopher Viles, Director of American Studies at the University of Connecticut at Storrs and co-editor of the U.S. Anti-Fascism Reader, who examines the disturbing historic analogs of street violence that accompanied the rise of authoritarian and fascist leaders of the past.
The bottom line is, yes, we should be worried, right? Because, you know, if someone was here on the show that was present during the civil rights struggles of the 1950s and 60s, they would probably tell you that this kind of violence against Black protesters is nothing new. In fact, it's all, you know, Black protest has always been met by vicious violence in this country, and that doesn't necessarily mean we've gone over to fascism. But what is new is, as you mentioned, that you have a president that's egging on militia groups directly, which is not something you had during, say, for, you know, the Eisenhower or the Kennedy administrations or the Johnson administrations, when civil rights was kind of going through its major phases. You didn't have, even when you had Nixon, who took a law and order stance, he wasn't actively egging on militias. And so that is a dangerous development in and of itself. And one of the things that, you know, I've seen the analogy before too, and I think this is both telling and not telling, or instructive and not instructive, is the analogy to Weimar Germany. In other words, Germany in the interwar period, when the left and the right were battling it out in the streets, sometimes bloodily with increasing escalation. One of the differences, I will say, between Weimar Germany and the United States now was that those bloody clashes between left and right, and right before Hitler's taking power, those bloody clashes were happening virtually every weekend in most major cities across the country. So right now we're still seeing it at flashpoints. We're seeing it at Portland. We're seeing it at Kenosha. So we're not seeing the kind of scale of political violence on the streets that you saw right before Hitler took power, or before there was a fascist takeover. And to be honest, we could talk about Trump and fascism in a moment, but how analogous is that situation? But what is dangerous, and what I have seen from this perspective of my research, that is worrying and that does echo history, that does echo the past, is this dynamic where like right-wingers will just kind of come into the territory of what they see as the left and just raise hell. So, for example, in Portland, you have this like armada of pickup trucks with guys coming in with guns, paint guns and real guns, just barreling into Portland, Oregon, only because they know it's a stronghold of people on the left, right? And you see that kind of behavior echoed over and over. The stormtroopers, for example, insisted on marching in kind of working class neighborhoods of Berlin and Hamburg that were known to be kind of socialist neighborhoods or communist neighborhoods. The Klan in the 1920s prided itself on marching through immigrant neighborhoods of the people they were targeting, whether it's Eastern European immigrants or Italian immigrants. So that is a hallmark of kind of fascist movements, of taking it to them, taking it to their strongholds with your guns, marching through their territory, their turf, their neighborhood. The left has its own pathologies, to be sure, but that's not something you see as much on the left, where it's just you're going to get a lot of like leftists going into some small town in like Kansas just because people vote for Trump there, and just with guns, right, just to scare people and cause a ruckus. So that behavior, I think, is really that provocative behavior, trying to deliberately trigger a fight, deliberately trigger something in the local population, is a direct echo of the past that I do see.
Donald Trump has signaled that he may not abide by the election results. There's a growing concern around the country that if he should lose the election, that he'll claim that the election was rigged, full of fraudulent ballots and such. What is the potential for violence if Trump does call out his supporters and resists the mandate of the people for him to exit the White House?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a very real question. And really what this is going to come down to, and it's kind of really super sad and scary that we're even having to talk like this, is will the police and will the, you know, if need be the military, can they be counted on to, you know, enforce the laws, you know? And I think probably so, but I think if they actually do steal the election, it'll probably be through lawyers and things. But I think something to keep in mind too is if Trump loses and if he doesn't, you know, somehow steal the election, the danger that he's created with fomenting all of this white nationalist violence, that's not going to go away. And in fact, you know, if he loses, again, I'm not saying he will, but if he does, I think we're going to see a lot of domestic terrorism, unfortunately, for a long time to come as a result of the kind of the hatred that he has created in American politics and life.
That was Christopher Viles, Director of American Studies at the University of Connecticut at Storrs and co-editor of the U.S. Anti-Fascism Reader. Learn more about the rise of armed militias and paramilitary forces that have undermined or destroyed democracies through history by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Toohoos, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.